Well, Share of Honor, it's a book that I'm on page 219. I can barely put it down. It's just one of these things that is just, it's absolutely riveting.
Good.
You did grow up in the Philippines, didn't you?
Yeah, I was there the last 2 years of high school. Thought it was the most glamorous life that I ever lived. You can't imagine what it was like to be 16 years old, a teenage kid, and suddenly living in Manila with my stepfather as the high commissioner of the country. It was just marvelous.
Was this the Simpson School?
Yes, which is really Brent School. I just called it Simpson in the novel because I wanted to do whatever I wanted to with it. But that was the school in Baguio where my brother and I went to school for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I graduated the summer of 1941, so I went back to the States and missed the war until I came back as a soldier the last year of the war.
Now, your stepfather, did he take the whole family back to the U.S.?
No. They stayed there, and when war broke out, they went to Corregidor with MacArthur and with President Quezon, and they escaped from Corregidor by submarine all the way to Australia underwater.
Did they escape with MacArthur?
No, MacArthur came out. It was about the same time, but MacArthur came out by PT boat down to the Southern Islands and then flew down to Australia. And my family came out entirely by submarine.
So you left to go to college?
Yeah.
And where did you go to school here?
I went to Williams.
So did you...
I had 1 year then at college and then got drafted and made my way eventually back to the Philippines.
So what year did you get back to the Philippines?
End of 1944 and the spring of 1945. That was spring of 1945. February was when MacArthur really liberated Manila.
So I guess that was a very vivid period in your mind that has stayed with you after all of these years.
Incredibly. Very much so. And I, as often as I could when I was working for Life magazine, whenever I had a trip anywhere within 5,000 miles of the Philippines, I would make sure that somehow or other I had to fly home through Manila. So I've been back a number of times.
Must be one of your favorite cities in the world.
It is. Huh? It still is.
Well, what was it like when you were a teenager in Manila?
Well, I'd grown up in Washington, D.C. in a perfectly pleasant, perfectly ordinary house. And suddenly we live in what is today the U.S. Embassy. Then it was called the High Commissioner's Residence. And we had air conditioning at a time when nobody had air conditioning. We had a Cadillac with a US-1 license plate. This didn't impress my stepfather at all. It just impressed us teenagers. With a siren and a flag on the front fender. And my stepfather was much too modest to drive with a siren. He just thought that was improper. But my brother and I had no such compunctions. Whenever we got in the car alone, we'd get the chauffeur, turn him loose on the siren. And, you know, 16, 14-year-old kids driving down Dewey Boulevard in a black Cadillac with a flag on the fender and a siren going, this is real stuff.
Yeah. Were you a member of the country club that you describe in Share of Honor?
I was too young. My stepfather was an honorary member of the, automatically, of the polo club, which is the one I described. And, yes, I went there, but I was too young to be a member.
Now, when you went back, I guess as part of the liberating force, or occupying, not occupying forces, but liberating forces, what kind of changes had there been?
Well, when I arrived, I was not combat infantry, so I didn't get to Manila until after the battle for Manila was over, but the city was destroyed. I think the common agreement among historians is that next to Warsaw, Manila was the most destroyed Allied city in the entire World War II. So it was a mess. It had gone through 3 years of Japanese occupation where things hadn't been kept up too well. Then came the American bombing and shelling, and my own house, the embassy, was tremendously shattered. I went over to see that, and here's this place that I had thought of as a beautiful, beautiful palatial home, and it was just rubble all through the front part. And I had quite a time persuading the guards that I had once lived in this house and therefore ought to be allowed to walk through it. You know, I'm a sergeant. I don't look like I own this house. Very hard to persuade them.
I have a feeling that in reading the novel that you don't emphasize with the Japanese too much. I mean, the Japanese are certainly cruel in this war, and they don't come off well at all in your book, do they?
No, I think I have one Japanese character, an admiral, in command of the port of Manila, who's an imaginary character. I think he comes off quite well. And individual Japanese behaved very well. Some really made an effort to make things function. But the Japanese had such a wonderful reputation for organization. And the Philippines was very badly organized under the occupation. The prison camps, where, as you know, I spend a lot of my book, takes place in both the civilian and military prison camps. And the Japanese didn't supply water, they didn't supply food, they didn't supply medicine. We all think of every American knows Pearl Harbor, of course, what a terrible event that was. 2,300 American military lives were lost at Pearl Harbor. Twice that many Americans died in prison camp in the Philippines after the fighting stopped. Just terrible performance on the part of the Japanese command.
But it was more than just a lack of performance. It seemed to be intentional cruelty. The prison camp commander in your novel greets the prisoners by saying something to the effect, "You are an enemy, you are my prisoners, I don't regard you as prisoners of war."
Right. He called the Americans animals, and he was an animal himself. That's one of the few characters in my book who is a real person, Sunuyoshi. But part of Sunuyoshi's problem, as awful as he was as a prison camp commandant, part of the problem was that the Japanese wound up getting three times as many American prisoners as they thought they were going to get. So they didn't have any preparation. They didn't have the food and the water. And Sunuyoshi was a real bad fellow, no question about that, cruel and incompetent. And, of course, the Bataan Death March, which is in the book at some length, there were many acts of cruelty during that. But it's a myth, an American myth, that the Bataan Death March was an organized atrocity. It wasn't. It was a disorganized, horrible, accidental atrocity. No food, no water, no medicine, and then random acts of brutality.
Yeah, random acts of brutality and murder, that is not something that is typical of Americans, is it? During the Second World War, we never did anything like that, did we?
Nothing that bad. But I think troops of all nations, you'll always find bad apples performing. War cuts loose a lot of inhibitions, and some people behave nobly, and some people behave very, very badly. You could certainly get a list of American atrocities during the war, but nothing on the scale of the Bataan Death March.
Now, I remember reading, can't remember the author now, but it was called An American Guerrilla in the Philippines. Remember who the author of that book was? Ira Wolfert, I believe. Ira Wolfert.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes in that book a scene in which American soldiers take a young Filipino who is thought to be collaborating with the Japanese and tie him to a tree and smash him with the butts of their rifles and make his young sister drink his blood. And I remember reading this and I was shocked. I said, we don't do things like that, because I was a kid.
I know.
We don't do things like that.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling that that's probably an accurate story.
I would think that almost anything, any individual act of barbarism is a possible story. When I was in New Guinea on our way back up toward the Philippines, we ran across an American infantry sergeant who collected ears. And there was a lot of argument whether he really killed the people, the Japanese soldiers, whose ears he'd collected, or was he collecting ears from soldiers killed by others. Nobody ever got that one straightened out.
You described the civilian prison camp in that university, the oldest university in the...
Older than Harvard.
Older than Harvard. But it seems that the Japanese allowed the people in that prison camp to pretty well handle things themselves. Tell me about that.
The Japanese thought that they had far more American and also other nationality civilians in this big camp in Manila in Santo Tomas. At times, the population got up to 4,000 people. And the Japanese were very happy to let the Americans organize it, organize the camp, organize the food lines, the meal tickets, the showers, everything, as long as they didn't break any of the rules. And the rules were very explicit. There was to be no sex, and no liquor, and no leaving camp without specific medical permission. The Americans, of course, were able to get around these rules. Americans are very ingenious people when captured.
When it comes to liquor and sex.
Yes, yes. Correct. But the Japanese were eager in the early years of the occupation to let the Americans organize themselves, and in effect we Americans created our own city in that college, that university. During the last year of the war, things changed. The Japanese got very, very tough. They put the military police in charge of that of Santo Tomas, and rules got very, very tough indeed. Food was cut way back. People began to die of starvation. Of course, they'd been dying of starvation in the military camps all through the war. The military camps were far more barbaric than Santo Tomas, the civilian camp. And, you know, I think this survival that all these people, the survival and the courage it took and the ingenuity it took to survive, is, and the eventual return of MacArthur, is a real American epic. And it always bothered me that Americans don't know about it.
Now, the Japanese had a contempt for those who surrendered, didn't they? Because they didn't.
Oh, yes.
They never surrendered.
Definitely against Japanese military tradition. So that if you were a soldier, an American soldier, and surrendered, that's why Sunuyoshi, the camp commandant at O'Donnell, treated them totally without respect. It's just against Japanese military tradition to surrender. Our position, of course, is that if you're whipped, if there's nothing left you can do, surrender is a perfectly honorable act, either for us to surrender or for people to surrender to us. But the Japanese, indeed, you're right, they didn't treat it that way.
Now, in Share of Honor, you have interlocking stories of a variety of people doing different things in the civilian prison, the military prison, and also a group, an American in particular, who was part of the guerrilla movement. How successful was that?
There were a great many American and Filipino guerrillas all over the Philippine Islands. I just deal with a group that was fairly close to Clark Field, but they were throughout the islands. They were, some of them were bandits. They didn't do anything except live off the countryside, steal food from the farmers, harass the women folk of the villages, and general all-out banditry. Others were very serious. The great achievement of the guerrillas was not, however, a military achievement. It was not military action against the Japanese. It was collecting information and getting that information to MacArthur's headquarters, which took quite some doing in those days because the Japanese controlled everything.
Well, you show a whole spy apparatus working out of the civilian prison camp,
mm-hmm.
and quite successfully. Too.
Yes, many Americans did try to collect information and get it out because they all believed that everybody believed MacArthur was going to return as he promised. The Filipinos just took this as the delivered word of God. I mean, MacArthur to them was a superhero, more than he was to Americans. But everybody believed that the Americans would be back. They couldn't believe it would take 3 years for MacArthur to return.
Why was it that there were so many Americans caught up in the Philippines at the time of the Japanese invasion? Why didn't they have some inkling that this was going to happen?
They were so, everybody was so sure that if war, there was nothing but talk about war, possible war with Japan in Manila during that last year before war finally came. But they were all convinced that America would win any such war. They were absolutely positive that Americans were just too good for the Japanese and the Japanese would be crazy to attack here. MacArthur helped foment that belief because he was he'd been the field marshal of the Philippines until he was called back to active duty the year before the war broke. And MacArthur had to keep up the spirits of his army and of the people. So he would give the same impression that America will win. Don't worry about it. And as a result, not just MacArthur, but I think all Americans were so over-optimistic that the attack, when it came, was an unbelievable disaster. Manila fell in just about 3 weeks. The Japanese walked into Manila. The whole country went, Bataan and Corregidor included, in 4 months. And we lost an army of over 100,000 Americans and Filipinos and lost the whole country. Tremendous disaster.
Your stepfather was the High Commissioner, which the Philippines, I guess, was really a colony at that time, wasn't it?
Oh, very much so. At that particular moment, it was called the Philippine Commonwealth, and it was about to get its own independence in 6 years. But my stepfather was he outranked the president of the Commonwealth. So, yes, he was the number one political figure in the country.
When did the Philippines become independent?
I believe the exact date was July 4, 1946. That was when it was scheduled to become independent. Actually, during the war, the Japanese held an Independence Day ceremony and declared the Philippines independent. They had bands, parades in Manila. Everybody knew it was a joke because the Japanese hand on the country was very heavy.
What has happened to the Philippines? There seems to be so much violence, murder, and revolution in that country today.
The Philippines has always been a very wild place politically. A Philippine national election doesn't bear too much resemblance to an American election. There are always abuses of military power. People get shot. Votes are bought. As we know, we saw this happen as recently as the Marcos Coriaquino election, where Marcos came within an inch of stealing an election that she had clearly won. I think if it hadn't been for two high-ranking Filipinos and a lot of pressure from the U.S., Marcos would probably still be in power.
But a candidate takes his life in his hands by running. He can be assassinated just simply because he's running.
He can be, and at the local level, they often are assassinated. Marcos, was found guilty of murdering a political opponent of his father's when he was a young man. He was convicted while he was appealing the case. He completed his law school work, then conducted his own appeal, and won the case. Very famous incident in Filipino legal annals. But yes, elections are violent. However, it is very unusual to have a president actually overthrown, as Marcos was, by the People's Revolution of Coriaquino. That hasn't happened since the Philippines became a commonwealth.
Why do you harbor so much affection for the Philippines, knowing that the country has this level of violence and instability?
Well, it also has an enormous... The Filipino people are the most likable people in the world, I think. They're very warm, very friendly, very terribly affable, sentimental, and very good humored, and they have a good sense of humor. It's a wonderful people, and the country itself is really different, exotic, strange. I mean, it's the one that I wound up discovering by accident when I was 15 and 16 years old. When something happens to you at that age, it really makes a lasting impression.
When you get back to Manila, what do you do?
Now?
Mm-hmm.
I see friends that I went to school with in 1941. Some of them are still in business in Manila. I drive out into the country with them and visit places that they all have the equivalent of dashas outside of Manila. I try to get up to see my old school, which is still in existence, which, by the way, when I went there, was exclusively white. No Filipinos allowed. Not one. Americans as colonialists managed to behave in the Philippines not unlike the way the British did in India.
You have a long career in journalism. Tell me about that.
Well, I knew that I wanted to write novels while I was in college, and I had one published, but I found...
While you were in college?
Yeah. But I found that I got $500 for it.
Wait, that was the...
It's not mentioned there.
It's not mentioned here.
It's called Thanks for the Ride.
Uh-huh.
1,800 copies sold, and if there are four copies in existence today, I would be astonished. I've got one.
You should have saved a few.
Yes.
What was that about?
It was a college novel. Knowledge about college, a novel about college life. But I realized I needed...
Based on Williams?
A mixture of Williams and Harvard, where I also went to college.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly Williams. Anyway, I realized I had to get a job, and I knew what I wanted to do to earn a living. I would go into the book publishing business, and then I would be with authors all the time and would see how books were... It seemed to me just the right thing. So I signed up for book publishing at the Student Placement Center, and I got a postcard saying, please come in on Wednesday, you have an interview. I think to myself, walking over, is it Random House, is it Doubleday, is it Scribner's? Turned out to be Life magazine. The Student Placement Center thought publishing was publishing. Didn't make any difference whether it was books or magazines or newspapers, or for that matter, radio or television. It would all have come out the same. And I had such a good talk that I wound up working there. And I checked with my writing teacher at Harvard at that time, asked him what he thought of my working for Life. And he said, well, he thought working there for 2 years wouldn't do me any harm. So I went ahead and took the job and had such fun, I stayed 35 years.
Wow, yeah. But that was an exciting time, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Late 40s, all through the 50s and 60s. It's a terrific time to be a journalist.
Yeah.
I think any time is a terrific time to be a journalist, but being fairly high up in the Life masthead in the 60s was quite an event.
Your title was what?
I was either assistant managing editor or the editor of the magazine throughout the 1960s.
And Life expired when?
1972.
And you left...
I was the last editor of the Weekly Life.
Yeah. Then you went over to Newsweek?
No, I stayed with Time Inc.
Okay.
I became a corporate editor and wound up finally as editorial director of the company. But after 35 years, I thought if I'm going to be a novelist, I'd better get back to it. So I left then.
And when did you leave Time?
6 years ago.
And when did you start working on Share of Honor?
Well, I wrote another novel before Share of Honor, after I left Time Inc. And that came out about 3 years ago, 3 to 4. I worked on Share of Honor about 3 years.
Because the reason I ask is that this doesn't come from memory. I mean, you did awful lot of very skillful research.
There's a little memory in it, especially of pre-war days in Manila, and there's a great deal of emotional memory of what the place looked like and how it felt and how I felt about it. But yes, the rest of it's all research, because I wasn't there during these war years. I was never in a prison camp, and I didn't get back until liberation. So yes, I had to do a lot of research. But I have many friends who lived through this experience. Many of the kids I went to school with were in Santo Tomas prison camp, and so I had lots of people to talk to who had really live this. And then I read many, many, many books.
Yes, it was a well-covered war, wasn't it?
And everybody who seemed to have been in the Philippines wrote a first-person account of what happened to him or her. They're often not very good, but boy, were they useful.
Well, what's it like? You're not practicing journalism. It's been 6 years. What's it like, the solitary profession of writing and the loneliness of your room?
I love
it. Your office or wherever you write.
I love it, and I only spend half a day at it, so it doesn't feel all that lonely. And I've always enjoyed writing. I hate research, but know that it's necessary and do a lot of it. And I'm doing research now on the next novel in the Philippines, which is going to be the early American days from the Battle of Manila Bay in 1898 through the first 4 or 5 years. I'll tell you one lovely fact from my research so far. The Battle of Manila Bay, Admiral Dewey destroyed 7 Spanish ships, the entire Spanish fleet, with his 6 ships. His total casualties were 8 wounded, nobody killed. I mean, there's never been a more efficient battle in the world than the Battle of Manila Bay.
Well, I can somehow see a trilogy in the works. You're going to have the early days of the Philippines, the war years, and you might do something more current.
Or I might do something in between. I'm really excited.
Something happened in between?
Well, there's a gap in there of about 35 years between the novel I'm working on now and Share of Honor. So,
were there some big events in Philippine history?
Nothing like either the first years or Share of Honor. It was a period of great political turmoil, but not of big events. So that's why I'm saving that for last.
Mm. Well, Share of Honor is a book that's hard to put down. It really moves, and it's frightening, and La Bataan Death March, that was really something to read. It's a terrific book, Ralph Graves. Thank you very much.
Thank you.